and he went away shaking his head. "Sometimes I think that boy is part machine," Emma said. "Flesh on the outside, metal on the inside." I laughed, but secretly I wondered if Enoch was right. Was it crazy what Bakir had risked for his son? Because if Bakir was crazy, then certainly I was. How much had I given up for the sake of just one girl? Despite my curiosity, despite my grandfather, despite the debts we owed Miss Peregrine, ultimately I was here, now, for one reason alone. Because from the day I met Emma, I'd known I wanted to be a part of any world she belonged to. Did that make me crazy? Or was my heart too easily conquered? Maybe I could use a little metal on the inside, I thought. If I'd kept my heart better armored, where would I be now? Easy. I'd be at home, medicating myself into a monotone, drowning my sorrows in video games, working shifts at Smart Aid, dying inside, day by day, from regret. "You coward, you weak, pathetic child, you threw your chance away." But I hadn't. In reaching toward Emma, I'd risked everything, was risking it again every day, but in doing so I had grasped and pulled myself into a world once unimaginable to me, where I lived among people who were more alive than anyone I'd known, did things I'd never dreamed I could do, survived things I'd never dreamed I could survive. All because I'd let myself feel something for one peculiar girl. Despite all the trouble and danger we found ourselves in, and despite the fact that this strange new world had started to crumble the moment I'd discovered it, I was profoundly glad I was here. Despite everything, this peculiar life was what I'd always wanted. Strange, I thought, how you can be living your dreams and your nightmares at the very same time. "What is it?" Emma said. "You're staring at me." "I wanted to thank you," I said. She wrinkled her nose and squinted like I'd said something funny. "Thank me for what?" she said. "You give me strength I didn't know I had," I said. "You make me better." She blushed. "I don't know what to say." "Emma, bright soul, I need your fire, the one inside you." "You don't have to say anything," I said. And then I was seized with the sudden urge to kiss her, and I did. Though we were dead tired, the gypsies were in a buoyant mood and seemed determined to keep the party going. And after a few cups of hot, sweet, highly caffeinated something and a few more songs, they'd won us over. They were natural storytellers and beautiful singers, innately charming people who treated us like long-lost cousins. We stayed up half the night trading stories. The young guy who'd thrown his voice like a bear did a ventriloquist act that was so good I almost believed his dummies had come alive. He seemed to have a little crush on Emma and delivered the whole routine to her, smiling encouragingly, but she pretended not to notice and made a point of holding my hand. Later they told us the story of how, during the First World War, the British Army had taken all their horses, and for a while they'd had none to pull their wagons. They had been left stranded in the forest, this very forest, when one day a herd of long-horned goats wandered into their camp. They looked wild but were tame enough to eat out of your hand, so someone got the idea to hitch one to a wagon, and these goats turned out to be nearly as strong as the horses they'd lost. So the gypsies got unstuck, and until the end of the war, their wagons were pulled by these peculiarly strong goats, which is how they became known throughout Wales as goat people. As proof, they passed around a photo of Bakir's uncle riding a goat-pulled wagon. We knew without anyone having to say it that this was the lost herd of peculiar goats Addison had talked about. After the war, the army gave back the gypsies' horses, and the goats, no longer needed, disappeared again into the forest. Finally, campfires dwindling, they laid out sleeping rolls for us and sang a lullaby in a lilting foreign language, and I felt pleasantly like a child. The ventriloquist came to say goodnight to Emma. She shooed him away, but not before he left a calling card. On the back was an address in Cardiff, where he picked up mail every few months, whenever the gypsies stopped through. On the front was his photo, with dummies, and a little note written to Emma. She showed it to me and snickered, but I felt bad for the guy. He was guilty only of liking her, same as me. I curled up with Emma in a sleeping roll at the forest's edge. Just as we were drifting off, I heard footsteps in the grass nearby and opened my eyes to see no one at all. It was Millard, back again after having spent the evening talking with the gypsy boy.
"He wants to come with us," said Millard.
"Who?" Emma mumbled groggily.
"Where?"
"The boy. With us."
"And what did you say?"
"I told him it was a bad idea, but I didn't say no precisely."
"You know we can't take on anyone else," Emma said. "He'll slow us down."
I know, said Millard. "But he's disappearing very rapidly, and he's frightened. Soon he'll be entirely invisible, and he's afraid he'll fall behind their group one day, and the gypsies won't notice, and he'll be lost forever in the woods among the wolves and spiders."
Emma groaned and rolled over to face Millard. He wasn't going to let us sleep until this was decided.
"I know he'll be disappointed," she said, "but it's really impossible. I'm sorry, Mill."
"Fair enough," Millard said heavily. "I'll give him the news."
He rose and slipped away. Emma sighed, and for a while she tossed and turned, restless.
"You did the right thing," I whispered. "It isn't easy being the one everybody looks to."
She said nothing, but snuggled into the hollow of my chest. Gradually we drifted off, the whispers of breeze-blown branches and the breathing of horses gentling us to sleep. It was a night of thin sleep and bad dreams, spent much as I'd spent the previous day, being chased by packs of nightmare dogs. By morning, I was worn out. My limbs felt heavy as wood, my head cottony. I might have felt better if I hadn't slept at all. Bekir woke us at dawn.
"Rise and shine, Sindrigasti!" he shouted,
tossing out hunks of brick-hard bread.
"There'll be time for sleeping when you're dead."
Enoch knocked his bread against a rock and it clacked like wood.
"We'll be dead soon enough with breakfast like this."
Bekir roughed Enoch's hair, grinning.
"Ah, come on. Where's your peculiar spirit this morning?"
"In the wash," said Enoch,
covering his head with the sleeping roll. Bekir gave us 10 minutes to prepare for the ride to town. He was making good on his promise and would have us there before the morning's first train. I got up, stumbled to a bucket of water, splashed some on my face, brushed my teeth with my finger.
Oh, how I missed my toothbrush. How I longed for my minty floss, my ocean breeze-scented deodorant stick. What I wouldn't have given just then to find a Smart-Aid store. My kingdom for a pack of fresh underwear.
As I raked bits of hay from my hair with my fingers and bit into a loaf of inedible bread, the gypsies and their children watched us with mournful faces. It was as if they knew, somehow, that the previous night's fun had been a last hurrah, and now we were being led off to the gallows. I tried to cheer one of them up. "It's okay," I said to a tow-headed little boy who seemed on the verge of tears. "We're going to be fine." He looked at me as if I were a talking ghost, his eyes wide and uncertain. 8 horses were rounded up, and 8 gypsy riders, one for each of us. Horses would get us to town much faster than a caravan of wagons could. They were also terrifying to me. I'd never ridden a horse. I was probably the only marginally rich kid in America who hadn't. It wasn't because I didn't think horses were beautiful, majestic creatures, the pinnacle of animal creation, etc., etc. It's just that I didn't believe any animal had the slightest interest in being mounted or ridden by a human being. Besides, horses were very large, with rippling muscles and big, grinding teeth, and they looked at me as if they knew I was afraid and were hoping for an opportunity to kick my head in. Not to mention the lack of a seat belt on a horse, no secondary restraint systems of any kind, and yet horses could go nearly as fast as cars, but were much bouncier. So the whole endeavor just seemed inadvisable. I said none of this, of course. I shut up and set my jaw and hoped I'd live at least long enough to die in a more interesting way than by falling off a horse. From the first giddy up, we were at full gallop. I abandoned my dignity right away and bear-hugged the gypsy man on the saddle in front of me who held the reins, so quickly that I didn't have a chance to wave goodbye to the gypsies who had gathered to see us off. Which was just as well. Goodbyes had never been my strong suit anyway, and lately my life had felt like an unbroken series of them. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. We rode. My thighs went numb from squeezing the horse. Bekir led the pack, his peculiar boy riding with him in the saddle. The boy rode with his back straight and arms at his sides, confident and unafraid. Such a contrast from last night. He was in his element here, among the gypsies. He didn't need us. These were his people. Eventually we slowed to a trot, and I found the courage to unbury my face from the rider's jacket and take in the changing landscape. The forest had flattened into fields. We were descending into a valley, in the middle of which was a town that, from here, looked no bigger than a postage stamp, overwhelmed by green on all sides. Tracing toward it from the north was a long ellipsis of puffy white dots, the smoky breath of a train. Bekir stopped the horses just shy of the town gates.
"This is as far as we go," he said. "We're not much welcome in towns. You don't want the sort of attention we draw."
It was hard to imagine anyone objecting to these kindly people. Then again, similar prejudices were among the reasons peculiars had withdrawn from society. Such was the way the sad world turned. The children and I dismounted. I stood behind the others, hoping no one would notice my trembling legs. Just as we were about to go, Bekir's boy sprang down from his father's horse and cried,
"Wait! Take me with you!"
"I thought you were going to talk to him," Emma said to Millard.
"I did," Millard replied.
The boy pulled a knapsack from the saddlebag and slung it over his shoulder. He was packed and ready to go.
"I can cook," he said, "and chop wood, and ride a horse, and tie all sorts of knots."
"Someone give him a merit badge," said Enoch.
"I'm afraid it's impossible," Emma said to him gently.
"But I'm like you, and becoming more so all the time."
The boy began to unbuckle his pants.
"Look what's happening to me."
Before anyone could stop him, he'd sent his pants to his ankles. The girls gasped and looked away. Hugh shouted,
"Keep your trousers on, you depraved lunatic."
But there was nothing to see. He was invisible from the midsection down. Morbid curiosity compelled me to peek at the underside of his visible half, which earned me a crystal-clear view of the inner workings of his bowels.
"Look how much I've disappeared since yesterday," Roddy said, his voice panicky. "Soon I'll be gone altogether."
The gypsy men gawked and murmured. Even their horses seemed disturbed, shying away from what seemed to be a disembodied child.
"I'll be winged," said Enoch. "He's only half there." Oh, you poor thing, said Bronwyn. Can't we keep him?
We aren't some travelling circus you can join whenever the notion takes you, said Enoch. We're on a dangerous mission to save our Imbrin, and in no position to play babysitter to a clueless new peculiar.
The boy's eyes grew wide and began to water, and he let his knapsack slide off his shoulder and fall to the road. Emma took Enoch aside.
That was too harsh, she said. Now tell him you're sorry.
I won't. This is a ridiculous waste of our precious and dwindling time.
These people saved our lives.
Our lives wouldn't have needed saving if they hadn't stuck us in that blessed cage.
Emma gave up on Enoch and turned to the boy.
If circumstances were different, we'd welcome you with open arms. But as it stands, our entire civilization and way of life are in danger of being snuffed out. So it's rather bad timing, you see.
It isn't fair, the boy moped. Why couldn't I have started disappearing ages ago? Why did it have to happen now?
Every peculiar's ability manifests in its own time, said Millard. Some in infancy, others not until they're quite old. I once heard of a man who didn't realize he could levitate objects with his mind until he was 92 years of age.
I was lighter than air from the minute I was born, Olive said proudly. I popped out of me mum and floated straight up to the hospital ceiling. Only thing that stopped me from rolling out the window and into the clouds was the umbilical cord. They say the doctor fainted from the shock.
You're still quite shocking, love, Bronwyn said, giving her a reassuring pat on the back. Millard, visible thanks to the coat and boots he wore, went to the boy.
What does your father think about all of this? He said.
Naturally, we don't want him to go, Bekir said. But how can we properly care for our son if we can't even see him? He wants to leave, and I wonder if perhaps he'd be better off among his own kind.
Do you love him? Millard asked bluntly.
Does he love you? Bekir's brow furrowed. He was a man of traditional sensibilities, and the question made him uncomfortable. But after some hemming and hawing, he growled,
Of course, he's my child.
Then you are his kind, said Millard.
The boy belongs with you, not us. Bekir was loath to show emotion in front of his men, but at this I saw his eyes flicker and his jaw tighten. He nodded, looked down at his son and said,
Come on then. Pick up your bag and let's go. Your mother'll have tea waiting.
All right, Papa,
the boy said, seeming at once disappointed and relieved.
You'll be fine, Millard assured the boy. Better than fine. And when this is all over, I'll look for you. There are more like us out there, and we'll find them one day. Together.
Promise? The boy said, his eyes full of hope.
I do, said Millard.
And with that, the boy climbed back onto his father's horse, and we turned and walked through the gates into town.
Chapter 6 The town was named Coal. Not Coal Town or Coalville, just Coal. The stuff was everywhere, piled in gritty drifts by the side doors of houses, wafting up from the chimneys as oily smoke, smeared on the overalls of men walking to work. We hurried past them toward the depot in a tight pack.
Quickly now, Emma said. No talking, eyes down.
It was a well-established rule that we were to avoid unnecessary eye contact with normals, because looks could lead to conversations, and conversations to questions, and peculiar children found questions posed by normal adults difficult to answer in a way that didn't invite still more questions. Of course, if anything was going to invite questions, it was a group of bedraggled-looking children traveling alone during wartime,
especially with a big, sharp-taloned bird of prey perched on one of the girl's shoulders, but the townspeople hardly seemed to notice us. They haunted the laundry lines and pub doorways of Cole's twisting lanes, drooping like wilted flowers, eyes flicking toward us and away again. They had other worries. The train depot was so small I wondered if trains ever bothered stopping there. The only covered portion was the ticket counter, a little hut in the middle of an open-air platform. Inside the hut was a man asleep in a chair, bottle-thick bifocals slipping down his nose. Emma rapped sharply on the window, startling the clerk awake.
8 tickets to London, she said. We must be there this very afternoon.
The clerk peered at us through the glass, took off his bifocals and wiped them clean and put them on again, just to make sure he was seeing properly. I'm sure we were a shocking sight. Our clothes were mud-splotched, our hair greasy and sticking up at odd angles. We probably stank, too.
"So sorry," the clerk said. "The train is full."
I looked around. Aside from a few people dozing on benches, the depot was empty.
"That's absurd," said Emma. "Sell us the tickets at once, or I shall report you to the Rail Authority for child discrimination."
I might have handled the clerk with a softer touch, but Emma had no patience for the self-important authority of petty bureaucrats.
"If there were any such statute," the clerk replied, his nose rising disdainfully, "it would certainly not apply to you. There's a war on, you know, and more important things to be hauled about Her Majesty's countryside than children and animals."
He gave Miss Peregrine a hard look.
"Which aren't allowed in any case."
A train hissed into the station and squealed to a stop. The conductor stuck his head out of one of its windows and shouted,
8:30 to London! All aboard!"
The bench sleepers in the depot roused themselves and began to shuffle across the platform. A man in a gray suit shoved past us to the window. He pushed money at the clerk, received a ticket in exchange, and hurried off toward the train.
"You said it was full,"
Emma said, rapping hard on the glass.
"You can't do that!"
"That gentleman bought a first-class ticket," the clerk said. "Now be gone with you, pestilent little beggars. Go find pockets to pick somewhere else."
Horace stepped to the ticket window and said,
"Beggars, by definition, do not carry large sums of money."
And then he reached into his coat pocket and slapped a fat wad of bills down on the counter.
"If it's first-class tickets you're selling, then that's what we'll have."
The clerk sat up straight, gaping at the pile of money. The rest of us gaped too, baffled as to where Horace had gotten it. Riffling through the bills, the clerk said,
"Why, this is enough to buy seats to an entire first-class car."
"Then give us an entire car," said Horace.
"That way, you can be sure we'll pick no one's pocket."
The clerk turned red and stammered,
"Yes, sir. Sorry, sir. And I hope you won't take my previous comments as anything other than jest."
"Just give us the blasted ticket so we can get on the train."
"Right away, sir."
The clerk slid a stack of first-class tickets toward us.
"Enjoy your trip," he said.
"And please don't tell anyone I said so, sirs and madams, but if I were you, I'd hide that bird out of sight. The conductors won't like it, first-class tickets or not."
As we strode away from the counter with tickets in hand, Horace's chest puffed out like a peacock's.
"Where on earth did you get all that money?" said Emma.
"I rescued it from Miss Peregrine's dresser drawer before the house burned," Horace replied. "Tailored a special pocket in my coat to keep it safe."
"Horace, you're a genius," said Bronwyn.
"Would a real genius have given away every cent of our money like that?" said Enoch. "Did we really need an entire first-class car?"
"No," said Horace. "But making that man look stupid felt good, didn't it?"
"I suppose it did," Enoch said.
That's because the true purpose of money is to manipulate others and make them feel lesser than you.
I'm not entirely sure about that, Emma said.
Only kidding, said Horace. It's to buy clothes, of course.
We were about to board the train when the conductor stopped us.
Let's see your tickets, he said,
and he was reaching for the stack in Horace's hand when he noticed Bronwyn stuffing something into her coat.
What's that you've got there?
The conductor said, rounding on her suspiciously.
What's what I've got where?
Bronwyn replied, trying to seem casual while holding her coat closed over a wriggling lump.
In your coat there,
the conductor said.
Don't toy with me, girl.
It's,
Bronwyn tried to think fast and failed.
A bird?
Emma's head fell. Enoch put a hand over his eyes and groaned.
No pets on the train,
the conductor barked.
But you don't understand, said Bronwyn. I've had her ever since I was a child, and we must get on this train, and we paid so much for our tickets.
Rules are rules,
the conductor said, his patience fraying.
Do not toy with me.
Emma's head bobbed up, her face brightening.
A toy,
she said.
Excuse me,
said the conductor.
It isn't a real bird, conductor, sir. We'd never dream of breaking the rules like that. It's my sister's favorite toy, you see, and she thinks you mean to take it away from her.
She clasped her hands pitifully, imploring.
You wouldn't take away a child's favorite toy, would you?
The conductor studied Bronwyn doubtfully.
She looks too old for toys, wouldn't you say?
Emma leaned in and whispered,
She's a bit delayed, you see.
Bronwyn frowned at this, but had no choice but to play along. The conductor stepped toward her.
Let's see this toy, then.
Moment of truth. We held our breath as Bronwyn opened her coat, reached inside, and slowly withdrew Miss Peregrine. When I saw the bird, I thought for one terrible moment that she had died. Miss Peregrine had gone completely stiff and lay in Bronwyn's hand with her eyes closed and legs sticking out rigidly. Then I realized she was just playing along.
See? Bronwyn said. Birdie ain't real. She's stuffed.
I saw it moving earlier,
the conductor said.
It's a... A wind-up model, said Bronwyn. Watch.
Bronwyn knelt down and set Miss Peregrine on the ground on her side, then reached under her wing and pretended to wind something. A moment later, Miss Peregrine's eyes flew open, and she began to toddle around, her head swiveling mechanically and legs kicking out as if spring-loaded. Finally, she jerked to a stop and toppled over, stiff as a board. Truly an Oscar-worthy performance. The conductor seemed almost, but not quite, convinced.
Well, he hemmed, if it's a toy, you won't mind putting it away in your toy chest.
He nodded at the trunk, which Bronwyn had set down on the platform. Bronwyn hesitated.
It isn't a... Yes, fine, that's no bother, said Emma,
flipping open the trunk's latches.
Put it away now, sister. But what if there's no air in there?
Bronwyn hissed at Emma.
Then we'll poke some blessed holes in the side of it,
Emma hissed back. Bronwyn picked up Miss Peregrine and set her gently inside the trunk.
Ever so sorry, ma'am,
she whispered, lowering and then latching the lid. The conductor finally took our tickets.
First class!
He said, surprised.
Your car's all the way down front.
He pointed to the far end of the platform.
You'd best hurry.
Now he tells us,
said Emma, and we took off down the platform at a jog. With a chug of steam and a metallic groan, the train began to move beside us. For now it was just inching along, but with each turn of its wheels, it sped up a little more. We came even with the first-class car.
Bronwyn was first to jump through the open door. She set her trunk down in the aisle and reached out a hand to help Olive on board. Then, from behind us, a voice shouted,
"Stop! Get away from there!"
It wasn't the conductor's voice. This one was deeper, more authoritative.
"I swear," Enoch said, "if one more person tries to stop us getting on this train..."
A gunshot rang out, and the sudden shock of it made my feet tangle. I stumbled out the doorway and back onto the platform.
"I said stop!"
the voice bellowed again, and looking over my shoulder, I saw a uniformed soldier standing on the platform, his knees bent in firing stance, rifle aimed at us. With a pair of loud cracks, he volleyed two more bullets over our heads just to drive his point home.
"Off the train and on your knees," he said, striding toward us.
I thought of making a run for it, but then I caught a glimpse of the soldier's eyes, and their bulging, pupilless whites convinced me not to. He was a white, and I knew he wouldn't think twice about shooting any one of us. Better not to give him an excuse. Bronwyn and Olive must have been thinking along the same lines, because they got off the train and dropped to their knees alongside the rest of us.
"So close," I thought. "We were so close."
The train pulled out of the station without us, our best hope for saving Miss Peregrine, steaming away into the distance.
"And Miss Peregrine with it," I realized with a queasy jolt.
Bronwyn had left her trunk on board the train. Something automatic took hold of me and I leapt up to chase down the train, but then the barrel of a rifle appeared just inches from my face, and I felt all the power drain from my muscles in an instant.
"Not another step," the soldier said.
I sank back to the ground. We were on our knees, hands up, hearts hammering. The soldier circled us, tense, his rifle aimed and his finger on its trigger. It was the closest, longest look I'd gotten at a white since Dr. Golan. He had on a standard-issue British Army uniform, khaki shirt tucked into wool pants, black boots, helmet, but he wore them awkwardly, the pants crooked and the helmet seated too far back on his head, like a costume he wasn't used to wearing yet. He seemed nervous, too, his head cocking this way and that as he sized us up. He was outnumbered, and though we were just a bunch of unarmed children, we'd been responsible for the death of one white and two hologast in the last 3 days. He was scared of us, and that, more than anything else, made me scared of him. His fear made him unpredictable. He pulled a radio from his belt and chattered into it. There was a burst of static, and then a moment later an answer came back. It was all in code. I couldn't understand a word. He ordered us to our feet. We stood.
"Where are we going?"
Olive asked timidly.
"For a walk," he said. "A nice, orderly walk."
He had a clipped, vowel-flattened way of speaking that told me he was from somewhere else but faking a British accent, though not particularly well. Whites were supposed to be masters of disguise, but this one was clearly not a star pupil.
"You will not fall out of line," he said, staring down each of us in turn. "You will not run. I have 15 rounds in my clip, enough to put 2 holes in each of you. And don't think I don't see your jacket, invisible boy. Make me chase you and I'll slice off your invisible thumbs for souvenirs."
"Yes, sir," said Millard.
"No talking!" the soldier boomed. "Now, march!"
We marched past the ticket booth, the clerk now gone, then down off the platform, out of the depot, and into the streets. Though the denizens of Cole hadn't given us a second glance when we'd come through town earlier, now their heads swiveled like owls as we trudged by in single file, at gunpoint. The soldier kept us in tight formation, barking at us when anyone strayed too far.
I was at the rear, him behind me, and I could hear his ammunition belt clinking as we walked. We were heading back the way we'd come, straight out of town. I dreamed up a dozen escape plans. We'd scatter. No, he'd shoot at least a few of us. Maybe someone could pretend to faint in the road. Then the person behind would trip, and in the confusion... No, he was too disciplined to fall for anything like that. One of us would have to get close enough to take his gun away. Me. I was the closest. Maybe if I walked a little slower, let him catch up, then ran at him... But who was I kidding? I was no action hero. I was so scared I could hardly breathe. Anyway, he was 10 whole yards behind me, and had his gun aimed right at my back. He'd shoot me the second I turned around, and I'd bleed out in the middle of the road. That was my idea of stupidity, not heroism. A jeep zoomed up from behind and pulled alongside us, slowing to match our pace. There were 2 more soldiers in it, and though both wore mirrored sunglasses, I knew what was behind them. The white in the passenger seat nodded to the one who'd captured us and gave a little salute, "Nice going," then turned to us and stared. From that moment, he never took his eyes off us or his hands off his rifle. Now we had escorts, and one rifle-wielding white had become 3. Any hope of escape I'd had was dashed. We walked and walked, our shoes crunching on the gravel road, the jeep's engine grumbling beside us like a cheap lawnmower. The town receded, and a farm sprang up on either side of the tree-lined road, its fields fallow and bare. The soldiers never exchanged a word. There was something robotic about them, as if their brains had been scooped out and replaced with wires. Whites were supposed to be brilliant, but these guys seemed like drones to me. Then I heard a drone in my ear, and looked up to see a bee circle my head and fly away. Hugh, I thought, what's he up to? I looked for him in line, worried he might be planning something that would get us all shot, but I didn't see him. I did a quick head count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In front of me was Emma, then Enoch, Horace, Olive, Millard, and Bronwyn. Where was Hugh? I nearly leapt into the air. Hugh wasn't here. That meant he hadn't been rounded up with the rest of us. He was still free. Maybe in the chaos at the depot he'd slipped down into the gap between the train and the platform, or hopped onto the train without the soldier noticing. I wondered if he was following us, wished I could look back at the road behind without giving him away. I hoped he wasn't, because that might mean he was with Miss Peregrine. Otherwise, how would we ever find her again? And what if she ran out of air, locked in that trunk? And what did they do with suspiciously abandoned baggage in 1940 anyway? My face flushed hot, and my throat tightened. There were too many things to be terrified of, 100 horror scenarios all vying for attention in my brain.
"Back in line!"
the soldier behind me shouted, and I realized that it was me he was talking to, that in my fevered state I'd strayed too far from the center of the road. I hurried back to my place behind Emma, who gave me a pleading look over her shoulder. "Don't make him angry," and I promised myself I'd keep it together. We walked on in edgy silence, tension humming through us like an electric current. I could see it in Emma as she clenched and unclenched her fists, in Enoch as he shook his head and muttered to himself, in Olive's uneven steps. It seemed like just a matter of time before one of us did something desperate, and bullets started flying. Then I heard Bronwyn gasp, and I looked up, a horror scenario I hadn't yet imagined taking shape before my eyes. 3 massive forms lay ahead of us, one in the road and 2 more in the field adjacent, just the other side of a shallow ditch. Heaps of black earth, I thought at first, refusing to see. Then we got closer, and I couldn't pretend they were anything other than what they were.
3 horses, dead in the road. Olive screamed. Bronwyn instinctively went to comfort her. "Don't look, little magpie!" And the soldier riding shotgun fired into the air. We dove to the ground and covered our heads.
"Do that again, and you'll be lying in the ditch beside them!" he shouted.
As we returned to our feet, Emma angled toward me and breathed the word, "Gypsies," then nodded at the closest horse. I took her meaning. These were their horses. I even recognized the markings on one, white spots on its hind legs, and realized it was the very horse I'd been clinging to just an hour ago. I felt like I was about to be sick. It all came together, playing out like a movie in my head. The whites had done this, the same ones who'd raided our camp the night before. The gypsies had met them along the road after leaving us at the edge of town. There'd been a skirmish, then a chase. The whites had shot the gypsies' horses right out from under them. I knew the whites had killed people, killed peculiar children, Miss Avocet had said, but the brutality of shooting these animals seemed to exceed even that evil. An hour ago they'd been some of the most fully alive creatures I'd ever seen, eyes gleaming with intelligence, bodies rippling with muscle, radiating heat, and now, thanks to the intervention of a few pieces of metal, they were nothing but heaps of cold meat. These proud, strong animals shot down and left in the road like garbage. I shook with fear, seethed with anger. I was sorry, too, that I'd been so unappreciative of them. What a spoiled, ungrateful ass I was. "Pull it together," I told myself. "Pull yourself together." Where were Bakir and his men now? Where was his son? All I knew was that the whites were going to shoot us. I was sure of it now. These imposters in soldiers' costumes were nothing but animals themselves, more monstrous even than the hologast they controlled. The whites, at least, had minds that could reason, but they used that creative faculty to dismantle the world, to make living things into dead things. And for what? So that they might live a little longer. So that they might have a little more power over the world around them and the creatures in it, for whom they cared so little. Waste. Such a stupid waste. And now they were going to waste us, lead us to some killing field where we'd be interrogated and dumped. And if Hugh had been dumb enough to follow us, if the bee flying up and down our line meant he was nearby, then they'd kill him too. God help us all. The fallen horses were well behind us when the soldiers ordered us to turn off the main road and down a narrow farm lane. It was hardly more than a footpath, just a few feet wide, so the soldiers who'd been riding alongside us had to park their jeep and walk, one in front and two behind. On either side of us the fields grew wild, bursting with flowering weeds and humming with late summer insects. A beautiful place to die. After a while, a thatch-roofed shack came into sight at the edge of the fields. "That's where they'll do it," I thought. "That's where they'll kill us." As we got closer, a door opened, and a soldier stepped out of the shack. He was dressed differently than the ones around us. Instead of a helmet, he wore a black-brimmed officer's hat, and instead of a rifle, he carried a holstered revolver. This one was in charge. He stood in the lane as we approached, rocking on his heels and flashing a pearly grin.
"We meet at last," he called out. "You've given us quite the go-round, but I knew we'd catch you in the end. Only a matter of time."
He had pudgy, boyish features, thin hair that was so blonde it was almost white, and he was full of weird, chipper energy, like an over-caffeinated Cub Scout leader. But all I could think when I looked at him was animal, monster, murderer.
"Come in, come in,"
the officer said, pulling open the shack's door.
Friends of yours are waiting inside.
As his soldiers shoved us past him, I caught a glimpse of the name stitched on his shirt. White, like the color. Mr. White. A joke, maybe? Nothing about him seemed genuine, that least of all. We were pushed inside, shouted into a corner. The shack's one room was bare of furniture and crowded with people. Bakir and his men sat on the floor with their backs to the walls. They'd been treated badly. They were bruised, bleeding, and slouched in attitudes of defeat. A few were missing, including Bakir's boy. Standing guard were two more soldiers. That made six altogether, including Mr. White and our escorts. Bakir caught my eye and nodded gravely. His cheeks were purpled with bruises.
"I'm sorry,"
he mouthed to me. Mr. White saw our exchange and skipped over to Bakir.
"Aha! You recognize these children?"
"No,"
Bakir said, looking down.
"No?"
Mr. White feigned shock.
"But you apologized to that one? You must know him unless you make a habit of apologizing to strangers."
"They aren't the ones you're looking for," Bakir said.
"I think they are," said Mr. White. "I think these are the very children we've been looking for. And furthermore, I think they spent last night in your camp."
"I told you, I've never seen them before."
Mr. White clucked his tongue like a disapproving schoolmarm.
"Gypsy, do you remember what I promised to do if I found out you were lying to me?"
He unsheathed the knife from his belt and held it against Bakir's cheek.
"That's right. I promised to cut your lying tongue out and feed it to my dog. And I always keep my promises."
Bakir met Mr. White's blank stare and stared back, unflinching. The seconds spun out in unbearable silence. My eyes were fixed on the knife. Finally, Mr. White cracked a smile and stood smartly upright again, breaking the spell.
"But," he said cheerily, "first things first."
He turned to face the soldiers who had escorted us.
"Which of you has their bird?"
The soldiers looked at one another. One shook his head, then another.
"We didn't see it,"
said the one who'd taken us prisoner at the depot. Mr. White's smile faltered. He knelt down next to Bakir.
"You told me they had the bird with them," he said.
Bakir shrugged.
"Birds have wings. They come and go."
Mr. White stabbed Bakir in the thigh. Just like that, quick and emotionless, the blade going in and out. Bakir howled in surprise and pain and rolled onto his side, gripping his leg as blood began to flow. Horace fainted and slid to the floor. Olive gasped and covered her eyes.
"That's twice you've lied to me,"
Mr. White said, wiping the blade clean on a handkerchief. The rest of us clenched our teeth and held our tongues, but I could see Emma plotting revenge already, clasping her hands together behind her back, getting them nice and warm. Mr. White dropped the bloody handkerchief on the floor, slid the knife back into its sheath, and stood up to face us. He was almost, but not quite, smiling, his eyes wide, unibrow raised in a capital M.
"Where is your bird?"
he asked calmly. The nicer he pretended to be, the more it scared the hell out of me.
"She flew away," Emma said bitterly. "Just like that man told you."
I wished she hadn't said anything. Now I was afraid he'd single her out for torment. Mr. White stepped toward Emma and said,
Her wing was injured. You were seen with her just yesterday. She couldn't be far from here.
He cleared his throat.
I'll ask you again.
She died, I said. We threw her in a river. Maybe if I were a bigger pain in his butt than Emma, he'd forget she'd ever spoken. Mr. White sighed. His right hand glided across his holstered gun, lingered over the handle of his knife, then came to rest on his belt's brass buckle. He lowered his voice, as if what he was about to say were meant for my ears only.
I see what the trouble is. You believe there's nothing to be gained by being honest with me, that we will kill you regardless of what you do or say. I need you to know this is not the case. However, in the spirit of total honesty, I will say this. You shouldn't have made us chase you. That was a mistake. This could have been so much easier, but now everyone's angry, you see, because you've wasted so much of our time.
He flicked a finger toward his soldiers.
These men, they'd very much like to hurt you. I, on the other hand, am able to consider things from your point of view. We do seem frightening. I understand that. Our first meeting on board my submarine was regrettably uncivil. What's more, your Imbrins have been poisoning you with misinformation about us for generations, so it's only natural that you'd run. In light of all that, I'm willing to make you what I believe to be a reasonable offer. Show us to the bird right now, and rather than hurting you, we'll send you off to a nice facility where you'll be well looked after. Fed every day, each with your own bed. A place no more restrictive than that ridiculous loop you've been hiding in all these years.
Mr. White looked at his men and laughed.
Can you believe they spent the last, 70 years on a tiny island, living the same day over and over? Worse than any prison camp I can think of. It would have been so much easier to cooperate.
He shrugged, looked back at us.
But pride, venal pride, got the better of you. And to think, all this time we could have been working together toward a common good. Working together, said Emma. You hunted us, sent monsters to kill us. Damn it, I thought, keep quiet.
Mr. White made a sad puppy dog face.
Monsters? He said. That hurts. That's me you're talking about, you know. Me and all my men here. Before we evolved. I'll try not to take your slight personally, though. The adolescent phase is rarely attractive, whatever the species.
He clapped his hands sharply, which made me jump.
Now then, down to business.
He raked us with a slow, icy stare, as if scanning our ranks for weakness. Which of us would crack first? Which would actually tell him the truth about where Miss Peregrine was? Mr. White zeroed in on Horace. He'd recovered from his faint, but was still on the floor, crouched and shaking. Mr. White took a decisive step toward him. Horace flinched at the click of his boots.
Stand up, boy.
Horace didn't move.
Someone get him up.
A soldier yanked Horace up roughly by his arm. Horace cowered before Mr. White, his eyes on the floor.
What's your name, boy? Horace? Horace... You seem like someone with abundant common sense.
so I'll let you choose.
Horace raised his head slightly.
Choose?
Mr. White unsheathed the knife from his belt and pointed it at the gypsies.
Which of these men to kill first? Unless, of course, you'd like to tell me where your Imbrin is. Then no one has to die.
Horace squeezed his eyes shut, as if he could simply wish himself away from here.
Or, Mr. White said, if you'd rather not choose one of them, I'd be happy to choose one of you. Would you rather do that?
No! Then tell me!
Mr. White thundered, his lips snarling back to reveal gleaming teeth.
Don't tell them anything, Sindragasti!
Shouted Bakir. And then one of the soldiers kicked him in the stomach, and he groaned and fell quiet. Mr. White reached out and grabbed Horace by the chin, trying to force him to look right into his horrible blank eyes.
You'll tell me, won't you? You'll tell me, and I won't hurt you.
Yes,
Horace said, still squeezing his eyes shut, still wishing himself gone, yet still here.
Yes, what?
Horace drew a shaking breath.
Yes, I'll tell you.
Don't! Shouted Emma.
Oh, God, I thought. He's going to give her up. He's too weak. We should have left him at the menagerie.
Shh! Mr. White hissed in his ear. Don't listen to them. Now, go ahead, son. Tell me where that bird is.
She's in the drawer, said Horace.
Mr. White's unibrow knit together.
The drawer. What drawer?
Same one she's always been in, said Horace.
He shook Horace by the jaw and shouted,
What drawer?
Horace started to say something, then closed his mouth, swallowed hard, stiffened his back. Then his eyes came open, and he looked hard into Mr. White's and said,
Your mother's knicker's drawer.
And he spat right in Mr. White's face. Mr. White slammed Horace in the side of the head with the handle of his knife. Olive screamed, and several of us flinched in vicarious pain as Horace dropped to the floor like a sack of potatoes, loose change and train tickets spilling out of his pockets.
What's this?
Said Mr. White, bending down to look.
I caught them trying to catch a train, said the soldier who'd caught us.
Why are you just telling me this now?
The soldier faltered.
I thought...
Never mind,
Mr. White said.
Go intercept it. Now.
Sir?
Mr. White glanced at the ticket, then at his watch.
The 8:30 to London makes a long stop at Porthmadog. If you're quick, it'll be waiting for you there. Search it from front to back, starting with first class.
The soldier saluted him and ran outside. Mr. White turned to the other soldiers.
Search the rest of them, he said. Let's see if they're carrying anything else of interest. If they resist... Shoot them.
While two soldiers with rifles covered us, a third went from peculiar to peculiar, rooting through our pockets. Most of us had nothing but crumbs and lint, but the soldier found an ivory comb on Bronwyn.
Please, it belonged to my mother, she begged.
But he only laughed and said,
She might have taught you how to use it, mannish girl.
Enoch was carrying a small bag of worm-packed grave dirt, which the soldier opened, sniffed, and dropped in disgust. In my pocket he found my dead cell phone. Emma saw it clatter to the floor and looked at me strangely, wondering why I still had it. Horace lay unmoving on the floor, either knocked out or playing possum. Then it was Emma's turn, but she wasn't having it.
When the soldier came toward her, she snarled, "Lay a hand on me and I'll burn it off!"
"Please, hold your fire," he said, and broke out laughing.